U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Robert Mueller speaks about his special counsel probe for the first time since he issued his report. Did he put his thumb on the scale for Congress to impeach Donald Trump? Plus, the European parliamentary elections are a blow to centrist parties as nationalists rise on the right and Greens do the same on the left. Welcome. I'm Paul Gigot with The Wall Street Journal and here with my colleagues, Kyle Peterson. Hello, Kyle.
Hello, hello.
And Joe Sternberg out of London. Hello, Joe.
Hi, Paul.
So let's start with Robert Mueller. He gave a statement on short notice that sounded to me as if in part it was an attempt to deflect the pressure from Capitol Hill to testify before the House Judiciary Committee about his report. He clearly doesn't want to go, as he said, beyond the four corners of the report. And if, in fact, he is forced to testify, he will not, he said, go beyond those four corners. But when you listen to his statement today, I thought that while there was nothing factually new, the emphasis that he put here in many ways was he went out of his way implicitly, I think, if you read between the lines and maybe even in some of the lines on the President Trump's criticism of the special counsel probe, and explicitly said that he is not he did not they found insufficient evidence to charge a larger conspiracy regarding Russia and the Trump campaign. He didn't say we found no collusion. He said insufficient evidence, which is a lesser standard. And on obstruction, he basically said the reason we didn't reach any conclusion about charging the president was not because we concluded that he had not committed a crime, but because the Justice Department rules say a president cannot be indicted. There's real ambiguity there, Kyle, that could be an invitation to Congress to move on impeachment.
For sure. So I agree with you that there was nothing really factually new here. President Trump was very fast to his Twitter account, tweeting nothing changes from the Mueller report. And I think that's true. Mueller did say that he is going to go back to being a private citizen. He wants the report to speak for itself, which as a former, you know, as a law enforcement guy, seems pretty admirable. But I agree that the emphasis here is really striking. So the quote I have here is he says, quote, if we had confidence the president did not commit a crime, we would have said so. We did not, however, make determination as to whether the president did commit a crime. So that is some really striking ambiguity. I mean, he's saying the president did not commit a crime, but he did not commit a crime. And so what is the public supposed to do with that? What is everybody, you know, how are you supposed to read into that? And people can read into that whatever they want to read into that. And the question at some point then becomes to Democrats running for president, I think, is do you see something here that if you were elected, that you would direct your Justice Department to pursue?
My conclusion from that, Joe, will be that Democrats on Capitol Hill, many of them will now want to pursue impeachment on obstruction grounds, because there was also another statement in there that said, well, the Justice Department rules bar us from indicting a sitting president. The Constitution has other mechanisms, a means by which you can hold the president accountable if he committed crimes. That's an invitation, in my view, to impeachment proceedings. And I think this is going to raise the pressure on Nancy Pelosi to have to move to at least open an inquiry. What do you think?
It probably will. I mean, the thing that I find so problematic about this whole exercise today is that if Robert Mueller wanted to stay within the four corners of the report, which is what he should be doing, then he should have done that instead of coming out and giving a statement that seeks to partially resolve some of the controversy that's been swirling about this since the report came out without actually doing any of it. And I actually would think that the pressure for him to testify now becomes even greater just because there's so much ambiguity about what some of the bits of the statement today meant. You know, there's this assumption that that kind of testimony might benefit Democrats, and certainly they have the opportunity in the House to control a lot of those proceedings. But Republicans also arguably now deserve some opportunity to probe some of these statements if Mueller is going to be floating around out there.
But he made pretty clear he's not going to do that. If they invite him up and somebody says, some Republican says, so why didn't you decide to investigate the provenance of the Steele dossier? He's going to say, it's in the report. Everything he has asked of him, he's going to say, well, you read the report. And if it's not in there, well, I'm not going to answer further. That's what he's going to do.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that certainly is what he is going to do once he gets up there. But it would be, you know, certainly irresponsible for him at this point, having inserted himself so much, or, you know, having projected himself so much beyond the corners of what he wrote in the report, even just with a short statement today. I think that there is an argument to be made that, you know, really he can't now claim that he is some sort of good citizen Boy Scout if he isn't prepared to answer that kind of question from the other side.
But Robert Mueller is an honorable man, Kyle, as Mark Antony might say. he was clearly trying to protect his institutional interests in not just the special counsel probe, but also the FBI and his investigators. And yet, when you think about it, he said they're all honorable people and so on. Did he mean Peter Strzok? Did he mean Lisa Page, you know, who was on his – Peter Strzok was on his staff for some time before Mueller dismissed him and had, of course, said things about Donald Trump and the so-called insurance policy that the FBI investigation represented? That's not honorable behavior.
That's a fair point, and I do think it points to just the problematic nature of this special counsel setup in the first place. So if you take Mueller at his word, he says that the Justice Department policy precluded him from charging the president, so he wasn't going to go down that road. But he wanted to have a contemporaneous account of the facts, and so he wanted to, even if he couldn't charge a crime of obstruction, he wanted to get to people while their memories were still fresh, put it down in black and white, and put it in a report. So the, as I understand the law, the special counsel's report was not required to be made public. And in a sense, a contemporaneous account like that handed off privately to the attorney general, you know, that might have made some sense. But the public pressure to put this out was going to be enormous. He had to know that it was gonna be released or was going to leak. And so I just don't understand how he has not realized the ambiguity he's created and the problems that flow from that.
Well, I think he had to know it was going to be public, and I think it would. He knows it would have leaked if Barr had not made it public, and Barr knew that, which is one of the reasons Barr made it public. That's always going to happen, I think, in these cases that are so politically fraught. Maybe the ambiguity is what Mueller wanted. Maybe he thought, you know what? I think that the Justice Department rules bar me from making a judgment about obstruction of justice. That doesn't mean Congress can't make a judgment. And I think, if anything, he puts his thumb on the scale towards impeachment here. That's my inference. And I think they may take him up on that, Joe.
No, I think that it is going to increase the drumbeat. And you know what? At this point, if that really is the road that Democrats in the House want to go down, then again, they should do it instead of trying to shelter behind some, you know, conspiracy theories that had been developing about what might have been hiding in the redactions that Attorney General Barr made to the report. At least Mueller has cleared up some of that confusion today. But I mean, the structural problem of the sort that Kyle was talking about is that, this kind of decision really belongs in Congress, which is a format that is set up for there to be political winners and losers from something like this, and for them to hash it out. I mean, this notion of having a special prosecutor who will try to straddle the fence just isn't working.
Yeah, the impeachment process is its main virtue is accountability. If you pursue it, you will either benefit politically or you'll pay a price for it if you pursue it in an improvident fashion, or what the country decides is a too reckless fashion. So, but I think it's going to be fascinating to see how the Democrats react to this. And I think the media, I think many of them will say, now we have to act and start an inquiry. And the media will back them up in that assertion. And certainly the Democratic media, which is most of the media, will do so. And then the question is, once you open up an inquiry, if that happens, how do they stop a vote?
I think that's a good question. But you have to think about the context, too. I mean, we're now a month away from the first Democratic presidential debate. There's going to be 20 candidates on consecutive nights up on that stage. And so you're talking about an impeachment playing out in the context of a live presidential election. And I'm just not sure that the public is going to go for that, and that it makes it much more difficult for the proceedings to be perceived as nonpartisan and as high-minded. It makes it way easier for the other side to portray the proceedings as a political hit job out to get the president to destabilize him as he runs for president. And it may not. I mean, it may backfire. It may work to President Trump's benefit, because he can say that. He can say, this is just the Democrats trying to get me as I run for re-election. This is all political. I mean, I think you have to take that into account if you're Nancy Pelosi.
We're talking about Robert Mueller's statement to the country about his special counsel probe and the European elections and their consequences. And you're listening to Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with Joe Sternberg and Kyle Peterson here. Let's turn to the European parliamentary elections, which occurred over the late last week and into the weekend. And there was a blow in the elections to the centrist parties that have controlled and dominated in the center left and the center right in Brussels since the founding of the European Union. And they lost their majority, as their outright majority, although with coalitions they still might be able to govern in Brussels. But they lost it to an uprising on the right with nationalist parties in various countries, France, UK, the Brexit Party winning with 32% of the vote, and Italy, among others. And then on the left with the Greens rising as well. Joe, is there a pan-European lesson here beyond for the specific countries?
Well, I think the big lesson is just that voters in Europe are desperate for more competition across more policy and political areas. I think that the feature of this big broad coalition between the center-right and the center-left that's been in charge for such a long time was this desire to suppress debate as much as possible on issues about the future of the European Union itself, what kind of EU European citizens want to have, more recent controversies about migration policy and how to deal with the refugees that started coming in 2015. And voters are just fed up with that. And so I think that the big story isn't so much the rise of nationalists on the right or the Greens on the left. The key point here is just the rise of more competitive parties across the spectrum,
rather than a kind of mushy centrism that, defers political decisions to the mandarins in Brussels. The people are saying, we want to say here. We want some of the choices delineated. We want more policy debates, actual policy debates, instead of deferring to Mr. Juncker and the head of the EU and whoever his successor is.
Exactly. And what is frustrating is that already you can see efforts starting to thwart that expressed will of the voters in one way or another. So there's talk about how they can try to bring in another party or two to keep alive the grand left-right coalition that has been in charge in the European Parliament for decades. Or there's talk that somehow the bureaucratic European commissioners alongside the heads of the member state governments will try to rig the process for selecting Jean-Claude Juncker's replacement as the head of the European Commission, which is one of the first tasks that the new parliament would face. And it is just this constant unwillingness to let democratically elected politicians fight it out in a venue like the parliament, which is supposed to be built for that.
The consequences for the internal politics of some of these nation states, who still obviously control their own destinies for the most part, even though they've ceded a fair bit of power to Brussels. These are even more interesting in a way because it's fascinating to see that take, for example, the UK, United Kingdom, where Nigel Farage's Brexit Party came out of nowhere to win 32%. The Tories collapsed to 9%, I mean, which is just unheard of for a party that still controls the prime ministership and has a working majority, at least in the parliament in UK. My own view of this is if the Tories don't deliver Brexit, they will self-destruct as a party.
I think that that is increasingly clear. I mean, it's not entirely clear what their future is going to be after Brexit, if it does happen, but I think that they are not going to have a future if they don't deliver Brexit, is the dilemma that they've got right now. And, you know, the main thing that we discovered, because certainly, of course, now we're also in the middle of a race within the Conservative Party in Britain to replace Theresa May as prime minister. And again, the theme that is emerging is just that, you know, the success of Nigel Farage's Brexit Party highlights how much frustration there is, not just on the Brexit issue itself, but also on this growing sense that the British mainstream parties have become so disconnected from ordinary people, so out of tune with where the political mood is, that just on a practical level of competence, they are incapable of governing effectively.
And the dilemma for the Tories as they choose a new leader is that their base, the large part of the rank and file, favors leaving the European Union, but they're represented by members of Parliament, Kyle, who don't. Even their own members, there's not a majority of Tory members, Tory MPs for Brexit.
Right, right. So I take the point about the center not being representative of people's views, though, I mean, I'm no expert on European affairs, but as an American watching this, it makes me a little bit thankful to live in a two-party system where, we live in an age where there are all these centrifugal forces in politics, social media, the internet, pushing people off to the sides in 10 different directions. And in a two-party system, there is sometimes some ugly coalition building and some primary fights, some fractiousness within the two parties, but it does seem to channel things somewhat, at least, toward the center and away from the extreme left, the extreme right, the extreme north, south, what have you.
Well, Joe, what do you think about the Tories? Is Boris Johnson, the former foreign secretary and former mayor of London, former newspaper man, current columnist, is he going to emerge with the Tory leadership? There are now, I think, 11 members of the party running. Boris is the favorite if you look at the polls, but no sure thing.
Yeah, he is the favorite. The problem is that the recent leadership elections have tended to err on the side of chaos. And certainly there was a period back in 2016 after the EU referendum when Boris was running for the leadership job and everyone thought that he was a clear front runner, and then he ended up falling down at the finish line. And that was how we ended up with Theresa May as the prime minister for the past 3 years. So it's a very variable process right now. I think that their challenge is that you need to tick two boxes. You need someone who the party base will trust to deliver Brexit, but then you also need a politician who is going to have the economic vision for the British economy after Brexit in order for people to feel like the economy will really succeed as a result of their policies.
And Boris Johnson has the first of those, but by no means the second, at least that I've detected. He seems to be a politician who survives on cunning and charisma more than he does his policy chops.
Exactly. I think one of the sad ironies of this process is that most of the conservative politicians who seem to have the clearest idea of the sort of economic reforms Britain would need to unleash its dynamism after Brexit, all of those conservatives seem to gravitate toward the pro-EU remaining side, whereas you have very few people who would pursue a harder form of Brexit that the voters seem to want, but also would be prepared to push for some of the reforms that Britain would need after that.
And if the Tories can't get their act together, we could end up with Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour Party leader, although Labour took a drubbing as well for its ambiguous stance on Brexit. The result is, with voters defecting to the Liberal Democrats, what we're likely to see is, in my view, is that the Labour Party is going to probably, and maybe Corbyn will move there too, unite behind a second referendum that would require the voters to vote again about on Brexit and take a harder Remain stance. And if the Tories mess up again, the British people could end up electing Jeremy Corbyn, who would be the most left-wing prime minister maybe in British history.
Right. It is a very real danger, and I think that it is growing day by day because, as you pointed out, I think that Labour has taken fright at the drubbing that they got in the European Parliament elections here last week. That is going to pull them much more in a Remain direction that is in line with a lot of parts of their base, although it's not Corbyn's personal view. And so that is going to set up a situation where Labour will start reemerging as the only available alternative for people who think that the Conservatives have either mismanaged Brexit or the economy. And I think that, unfortunately, the fact that Corbyn's socialist views on economic matters are wrong isn't going to matter much if the Conservatives aren't giving him compelling opposition that voters are willing to rally around.
That's why we warned when Corbyn became party leader to some of the Tories, don't cheer, because you never know. I much prefer a moderate center-left party, Kyle, and I would say that is relevant to the United States, where Democrats are moving left, and sooner or later, the standard bearer for the Democratic Party is going to win. Because voters will get tired of Donald Trump or tired of the Republican Party. And you want that party, I want it to be more centrist than leftist. And they're moving left.
Right. To your point about choosing the opposition leader wisely, you recall the Democrats that were cheering when Donald Trump got the Republican nomination in 2016 and who are now rueing that day. As far as the Democratic Party goes, I mean, Bernie Sanders is on the socialist left and could still get the Democratic nomination, but it's by no means clear. Biden, who represents, again, sort of this centrist, progressive but not socialist, trying to appeal to the broad base of the party because that's how the party system is set up in the United States, is so far still way ahead, and there are others like Kamala Harris who are nipping at Bernie Sanders' heels there.
All right. Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Kyle. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later in the week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.